And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we begin, though, I want to let you know about a unique ebook that's yours to download free today. It's called Googling God, and in it you'll find truth-filled answers to the top five questions people ask online about God. Googling God outlines core apologetic responses to life's deepest questions, helping you know why you believe what you believe. More importantly, it will prepare you to respond with confidence and grace to questions and objections that come your way as you live and speak for Christ. Download your free copy of Googling God today by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources.
Well, good afternoon and welcome along to Unbelievable. That's unbelievable with a question mark. I'm your show host, Justin Brierley, this Saturday afternoon. And just a couple of days now to Christmas. I wonder, are you ready? Has the turkey been prepared? Have the presents all been wrapped? How are you celebrating Christmas? Well, however you're celebrating, I do hope you enjoy today's show. And perhaps you're listening via the podcast, which you can find, of course, at the website, premier.org.uk/Unbelievable. Many resources there for anyone who's interested in Christian apologetics, theology, Bible study. It's all available from there, links to things like the DVD of our conference earlier this year. That was Unbelievable, the Conference 2012, with some great speakers, including John Lennox, Krish Kandaya, Michael Green, Hugh Ross, Ken Samples, Bonnie Yule Kuhn, and more. So premier.org.uk/unbelievable. If you'd like to check that out, and indeed many of the past shows of this show. And I like to call this the programme that gets Christians and non-Christians talking. Normally the format is a Christian and a non-Christian, but we also do a format where we bring two Christians, perhaps of very different persuasions, together. And that's very much the vein in which today's show will operate. So let me tell you what's coming up on the show today.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
And as you can tell, we have something of a Christmassy theme to today's show, quite appropriately. And my guests on the show today, Ben Witherington III and Stephen Thornton. They're going to be discussing the Christmas story, fact of history, or theological invention. In other words, was it simply a teaching aid, if you will, for the early church? Let me tell you a little bit about my guest today, Ben Witherington III, Professor of New Testament at Asbury Theological Seminary in Kentucky. He's an author, speaker, very avid blogger, and, well, he's going to be defending the Christmas stories as having a historical foundation, as well as, of course, being significant in what they tell us theologically. Stephen Thornton, my other guest today, takes a very different line from Ben. He's a Bible teacher in the UK, but he's a liberal Christian and a retired church minister to boot. He says the Christmas stories were never meant to be taken as literal history, but there are things there that do teach us deep truths about Jesus and about faith. So that's what we're looking at today, two very different views of how we're meant to take the Christmas stories. And there are, of course, all kinds of issues that emerge from the narratives that we have in Matthew and Luke, because we do have some quite distinct stories there, and we'll be talking about that as we get underway on today's programme. Well, first of all, let me say a welcome to Ben Witherington. Ben, thank you very much for joining me today.
Glad to be here.
It's great to have you on the show. So you joined me previously to talk about the lost tomb of Jesus. That was a long time back now, Ben. But tell us a little bit about yourself. Tell us about what you do at Asbury Theological Seminary.
Well, I'm mainly dealing with doctoral students now. We have had a PhD in biblical studies now for the last 5 years, and I'm still working with doctoral students at St. Andrews in Scotland as well. So I'm mainly dealing with doctoral students, though I have some classes with graduate students as well in theology.
And since you, as it were, had a faith growing up, has your faith changed much in the course of looking into the historicity of the Gospels and so forth?
Well, I would say yes, actually. I mean, the time that I have spent for decades and decades now in the biblical studies area has just strengthened my faith. And I grew up in a fairly moderate Christian environment and went off to college like everybody and sowed my wild oats and really came to embrace the Christian faith for myself while I was in college through the challenges of good teachers who made me seriously think about the whole Christian story.
Mm. And when you teach the Christmas story in particular, and this time of year I'm sure you've been called upon to deliver messages on that, do you treat it as a historical sort of account of what happened around the time of Jesus' birth?
Well, I do, but it depends on what you mean by historical. I believe it's ancient historiography, not modern historiography, and I don't think it should be sort of measured or compared to, say, the modern story of World War II or whatever, because the ancient writers wrote according to different conventions than we have today.
Well, we'll get into that in the course of the discussion today. Let me introduce my other guest for this afternoon's discussion, Stephen Thornton. Stephen, thank you for being with me today.
That's good to be here.
You've looked at the Bible pretty much your whole life as well. Did you grow up with a Christian faith yourself, Stephen?
Yes, I grew up in a Christian family and a super congregational church, as it was then, in Yorkshire. And it was a very lively church, and we had a lot of good teaching and discussion and a lot of things that are missing in our churches today, where people really came to grips with biblical study.
Mm. And that's been a passion of yours down the years. You've ministered in various settings, but very, very often what you do today, in fact, what you've been doing just recently, is teaching others how you believe they should interpret the stories from Scripture. I mean, when it comes to the stories around Christmas, the birth narratives in Matthew and Luke, what's your general approach to that? Is it a concern to you whether they're historically accurate or not?
Yes, I think one of the important things to understand, and a lot of people seem to forget, is that these stories, as Ben has already mentioned, come from the Middle East. They aren't English. A lot of people think they're English and you treat them in an English way. Well, you certainly don't do that. And some people think of them as American. Well, they're certainly not American, and you don't treat them in an American way. So you've got to get behind a Middle Eastern culture of 2,000 years ago, which is quite a challenge.
Mm.
And, of course, they were written after the letters. So the letters of Paul come first, and the Gospels come later. So we have to ask who wrote them and what were they written for? And my understanding is that they were written by the church to teach the church. Here we have a young church, persecuted church, small church that needed help and teaching. So the Gospels are written by the church to teach the church. So they are a teaching document, not historical documents, not biographies. They are Gospels.
Hmm. Well, we're going to get into some of the substance of this today and look at the different accounts we have in Matthew and Luke. Matthew has magi visiting Jesus. Luke has shepherds visiting Jesus. Neither mentions the other in either account. Is that a problem? Some might cast that as a contradiction or something. Well, we'll get our guest's views on that. What about some of the external evidence for some of the details around the story? The census, was there a census? The star, the killing of the infants by Herod and so forth. All things that feature often in our Christmas nativities. But of course, as has been said before on this programme, our traditional nativity you'd see in a school or a church play is of course in many ways a blend of the different narratives the magi and shepherds all turning up to the stable at the same time. Well, we'll see what Ben and Stephen have to say about that in the course of today's programme. And if you'd like to contribute yourself, if you'd like to respond to anything you hear today, then I do encourage you to email in. And the way to do that is to email me at unbelievable@premier.com. unbelievable.org.uk. Don't forget you can also find us on Twitter at UnbelievableJB and Facebook.com/UnbelievableJB if you want to interact via Facebook. All those links and more besides, including links to past programmes you may be interested in, from the website of Unbelievable. That's premier.org.uk/Unbelievable.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So, with a Christmas theme ringing in our ears, let's look at the Christmas stories. You've heard there, Ben, what Stephen said his understanding of this is. I mean, I think, Stephen, it might be fair to say you would kind of dissociate the word biography altogether from these stories. You don't feel these were ever written down in any kind of meant to be as a historical understanding of what happened.
That's so, yes. They aren't meant to be historical. They're meant to be, as I've said, a teaching aid. And the question to ask throughout it all is not, did it happen like this? But the question to ask about the birth narratives is, what is the writer trying to say? What's the meaning behind these stories? So it's not, did it happen? Because clearly some of it didn't. But the question to ask is, what is the meaning? And there's deep meaning, and they're glorious stories, full of depth and truth. And the difficulty is some people know the stories, but have no clue what the truth is.
Someone might ask, well, you say they didn't happen. On what basis are you saying they didn't? Because there are some pretty fantastical elements to these stories that you would point to.
There were historians around in those days, and what Luke speaks of this census throughout the Roman world. Well, it's amazing that he could talk about this thing and no historian ever mentioned it. So you'd have thought that if it was a census throughout the Roman world, somebody would have mentioned it. So the question to ask is not, did it happen, because it didn't. The question to ask is, what is the meaning? And the meaning Luke has of the census is that this is an event which affects the whole world. It affects everybody. It's vital and central to everybody and everything. So the question is not, did it happen, but what is the meaning? And okay. The meaning is, it's for everybody.
Ben, what do you make of that? Is it simply about the meaning, or do we need some kind of historical basis to these stories to make sense of them?
Well, let me back up first and talk about genre, because what I understood Stephen to say is that the genre of what we're dealing with in the birth narratives is that they're gospels. They're not like ancient biographies. They're not like ancient historiography. And I would completely disagree with that. I don't think gospel is a genre of literature. I know that there were German scholars in the early 20th century that put forward that kind of case. But at this point, most New Testament scholars on whichever side of the Atlantic or whatever ocean you live next to do take seriously the fact that these documents look in various degrees like either ancient biographies or ancient historiographical works. Now, the thing that distinguishes those kind of works from, say, modern historiography is that the ancients were far more open-minded to the miraculous than modern historians are, which I don't frankly think that says much about the learnedness of modern historians. I think it makes them rather narrow-minded. So I would say that in the case of Matthew and Mark and John, we've got three documents that are indeed attempting to be ancient biographies, and we have in the case of Luke-Acts a two-volume ancient historiographical work. So that would be point number one. The second point I would make is that to make a bifurcation between theology and history, I don't really think works with early Jewish documents. I mean, most early Jews assumed that nothing could be theologically true that was historically false. That there are historical people. They believe they were historically redeemed out of bondage in Egypt. History is at the very bedrock of who they are and what they believe about their God. They believe their God acts in history. And so when an early Jew or an early follower of Jesus would read a story in Matthew 1 or 2 or Luke 1 and 2 or heard these stories, they wouldn't distinguish these stories from the stories of the ministry of Jesus. The ministry of Jesus has just as many miracles, just as many dreams or visions or whatever. They certainly wouldn't distinguish the stories on those kind of bases. So I think that they have historical substance, but I absolutely agree with Stephen when he says that the real point of what we're dealing with is what is the meaning of these events. Now, events only have meaning if there have been events. There need to be an event for to give a theological interpretation of them, and I think the gospel writers are presenting us with the events that are deep and rich with theological significance. I would like to touch on the whole business of the census, because that's really a pretty old canard. The truth of the matter is that there were censi, plural, in the Roman world in various provinces. The emperors were very keen on taxes. They didn't exempt any provinces except perhaps the Asia Minor province from taxation. We know for a fact that there were censuses taking in the Egyptian province, right next to the province of Judea, and that people went by tribal groups to register for the census. So I don't see a historical problem with the story about the census in Luke or about Mary and Joseph having to trundle off to Bethlehem to register for the coming taxation. It seems to me we have parallels from the province of Egypt. But that's not the big point. The big point is, of course, that the Messiah is coming into the world, the son of David, and that he's born in the ancestral birthplace of David.
Right. Okay. So thank you for that. That was fascinating. My understanding, of course, is that these birth narratives of the two Gospels, of course, haven't got birth narratives, and Paul never mentions anything about the birth narratives, which is fascinating. But so I see these birth narratives as the overture to the opera. If you're sort of musical and enjoy operas, as I do, the overture introduces us to the main themes that are going to be spelled out in the rest of the opera. So you hear these themes in the overture, and then as the opera goes on, you, ah, oh, that theme, yes, I knew that, and this theme and that theme. Equally, in these birth narratives, we're introduced to the main themes of the gospel, and then these themes are spelled out as the opera or the gospel continues, and that's their fascination. Clearly, the gospel writers use things that were known about in those days, and clearly there were censuses and registrations. So they use things that people know about in their stories. But if we turn to Matthew, this star business, well, fascinating. I mean, who in heaven's name has ever seen a star stop over somebody's house?
I mean, well, exactly. And this is where I say that ancient people believed that stars were beings. They thought they were the heavenly hosts. They didn't make rigid distinctions between what we would call angels and what we would call stars. And so it's just as plausible to think that this story is, in fact, about heavenly guidance of the Magi to the right spot. You're quite right. Stars don't sort of stop over the stable in Bethlehem and blink and with a neon sign say, stop here, the Messiah's here. I agree with that. But the point is that we should interpret these stories not in light of modern ways of thinking about even the heavens or the constellations. We should interpret them in light of how ancients saw these things, and I don't have a problem with the idea that God could have sent an angel to guide these people to where Jesus was born.
I mean, I think you have a problem with the idea of angelic visitations full stop, though, Stephen, if I'm not mistaken, because you find the idea of the appearance of the angelic host to the shepherds, for instance, again, somewhat implausible.
Well, it's not implausible. I think it's a different sort of writing. It's a picture, a glorious picture, and it's the same picture as the star. I mean, the same message as the star.
But it's not a picture that actually happened.
No. Have you ever seen a load of angels sitting on a cloud? I mean, nobody ever has, because it's a picture, not an event, for God's sake. I mean, who in this world has ever seen all these angels sitting on a cloud, apart from those who think they ought to have seen it, because in the Bible it talks about these hosts, but So it's a picture. Now, what's the meaning? The meaning is the same as the star, that all the heavens are engaged in this event. It's not just a hole-in-the-corner event.
If that's true, that all the heavens are engaged in this event, then I suppose it leads me to think, well, then could this not have been... Obviously, it's very unusual, doesn't happen every day, but perhaps on this occasion, spiritual beings that shone gloriously did appear to a bunch of lowly shepherds.
No.
Because it was such a momentous event.
One of the difficulties is people seem to have lost their imagination. And so we have to use our pictorial sense and our imagination. Children have got it gloriously. They share all sorts of stories. They know it didn't happen.
Do they? I'm not sure my children know it didn't happen. What do you make of this, Ben? Are we supposed to just take these as pictures? Is that what the literature is that we're reading?
Well, no. I mean, I think I agree with Stephen about the rich theological depth and significance of these stories. I think they have historical foundation to them. And, I mean, I have a colleague, Craig Keener, who's just written two massive volumes on miracles in antiquity and today. And there are plenty of sane, rational people today who not only claim to have seen miracles, but in fact to have encountered angels. And so, you know, I simply do not accept the position that suggests that what we have in the Gospels is very nice, quaint fairy stories about things that can't happen and do not happen, but they're theologically rich because they help explain to us who Jesus was. I don't accept that explanation because there are too many credible stories that such things have happened and continue to happen. That's point number one. And point number two is that when we're dealing with these ancient stories, I think it's enormously condescending to suggest that we know better than the original writers of these stories what actually happened. We were not there. We didn't experience these things. And quite incredible and miraculous things have happened all throughout human history. So I think we just sort of need to check that whole kind of approach to the text at the door and say, okay, let's be open-minded. This is what the story says. Is it possible? Is it plausible? Or is it made up?
So my response to that then is that what we have to do is ask, what is the nature of these writings? Now,
exactly.
Ben has one view. I have an entirely different view. That the nature of these stories, these writings, is theology to teach the church. They aren't fairy stories. They're glorious stories, full of deep truth, but not to be swallowed whole and not to be taken literally.
Why then, Ben, do you hold that these fall under this genre of ancient historiography, ancient biography, as opposed to... gospel you've used almost as a genre in itself, isn't it, Stephen? Which presumably that thus means something which was meant to teach rather than to give a historical account.
Yes, I mean, there are many other gospels as well as the four we've got, and you can find them in any library. There they are. Happily, these four will do for us. But there are plenty of other gospels, and they all have different stories. I mean, one of them has a story about Jesus' childhood. And it's a gospel, and it talks about Jesus growing up.
Presumably there was a reason why the early church wanted the four that we obviously are familiar with, included in the canon of Scripture. I mean, Ben, coming back to you, why then are you kind of firm in what you're saying, that this is actually...
Well, because I've read the other ancient biographies and the ancient historiographical works, and these works are absolutely comparable. I wouldn't begin to suggest that Tacitus' life of Agricola is not a biography, and yet that story is full of remarkable stories and sometimes miraculous stories about the life of Agricola. I wouldn't even begin to suggest, well, these are not historically substantive stories. When I read comparable ancient biographies or ancient historiographical works, they have these same kinds of stories. I mean, all the way back to Herodotus, the father of Greek history, you have the divine and the miraculous involved in the story. And so, you know, I don't think we can distinguish between what the Gospels are and other ancient biographies and historiographical works.
Presumably you're less...
On the basis of the contents.
Less willing to give credence, though, to the miraculous events in, say, the life of some of those other figures of history. I mean,
well, yes and no. I'm certainly not ruling out that miracles happened outside the gospel story. I wouldn't do that. I think they do happen. So, no, I wouldn't rule it out, but I think you have to read all of the evidence critically. That's what I think.
So,
and when you do that, you still end up with an irreducible amount of the miraculous in these stories, and they don't stop looking like other ancient biographies and other ancient historiographical works.
So, right, okay, thank you. So there are different views, which is true. I mean, I don't actually believe that being a Christian means that you've got to believe 1,001 unbelievable things before breakfast. And so we have to bring our minds to the matter and our studies to the matter and work out what they mean for us. And I suppose that's where I
mean,
am.
But not believing 1,001 unbelievable things before breakfast, Stephen, does that automatically imply that miracles don't happen? I mean, just because we don't tend to observe them very frequently in modern life, does that mean they didn't happen, especially, as you've said yourself, in an event as momentous as the birth of Jesus?
Actually, I believe miracles happening all the time. The congregations I speak to every Sunday, they're all miracles. Here are these people, wonderful miracles. All these people are miracles.
Obviously, that's a slightly different type of miracle.
It's exactly the same sort of miracle the gospel writers talk about. Here are people who are blind and now see, who are deaf who now hear, who are dead who now live. I mean, England is full of dead people walking around. And Jesus is the one who can bring dead people to life.
Right. Well, I'd still contend that that's a different type of miracle than what appears on the face of it to be Jesus raising people physically from death to life, even if we do imply a spiritual aspect to those stories. We're drawing close to the end of our first section here, gentlemen, and something I would like us to turn to in the next section, if we could talk about this, is the fact that the virgin birth, I think we should talk about at some level. Also, why the two stories are so different. And I think this is a question that you'll perhaps need to address, Ben. And give us briefly, before we go to the break, your in a nutshell view of to why Matthew and Luke essentially have very different details in the two stories. I mean, the sceptic might be willing to side at this point with Stephen and say, well, they were making it up because Matthew has some magi, Luke has some shepherds. They get to Bethlehem in different ways. One starts off in Nazareth, goes to Bethlehem. The other seems to be in Bethlehem, and then they return to Nazareth. One has the story of Herod. The other doesn't mention it. What's going on? Why do we have, in the two accounts, such very different accounts?
Well, the first thing I would say is that Luke is writing as a historian. If you look at his preface in Luke 1:1-4, he writes a preface that is very much like the preface to other ancient Hellenistic and Jewish historiographical works. So he's writing as more of a historian, and Matthew is not. Matthew is writing as a biographer. He's focusing on the life of Jesus as a characteristic ancient biography. So that would be the first thing. The second thing is that they're taking a different point of view. Now, when you have important events in history, you may have very different accounts of people who are eyewitnesses, who are actually there, because they approach the telling of the story from a different point of view. Broadly speaking, I would say that Luke tells the story from the point of view of Mary and the women in the story. Hence, we have the story of Mary and Elizabeth, whereas Matthew takes the point of view of Joseph and tells the story from the point of view of the men in the story, if you will. And so that accounts for a good deal of the differences. What's remarkable to me, since I don't think they were using each other, is the similarities in the story. The virginal conception, something to do with Nazareth, and something to do with Bethlehem. Now, those are our correspondences between the stories, and we can talk about that after the break.
We will. Okay, and we'll get Stephen's response as well. You're listening to Unbelievable, a festive Christmas edition, as we ask today, the Christmas story, fact of history or theological invention, a teaching aid, if you will, for the early church. And my guests are Stephen Thornton, who takes a liberal view on this. He says we don't need to take these stories literally. They're there to teach us things, deep truths. Ben Witherington III says, yes, there are deep truths in these stories, but they have a historical foundation and we mustn't forget that. So we'll be back in a moment's time as we continue to discuss this subject here on the show that aims to get you thinking about your faith, Unbelievable. ¶¶ Welcome back to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, a special festive edition of the programme. And if you want to listen back to past programmes, don't forget we're online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And I'd love to hear your thoughts as well on today's programme. I'm sure some of you have already been furiously typing away at the keyboards in response to what my guests Stephen Thornton and Ben Witherington III have had to say today. Unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the email address. You can also phone and leave a voicemail response, 08456 52 52 52. And select the option for Unbelievable. I'll try and play any messages out that come in that way. And don't forget, we've got some of your feedback to the last few weeks of programming towards the end of today's show. So stick around for that between 4 o'clock, just before four, we'll get to some of your feedback as well. Right, coming back to you both, gentlemen, as we address this question of the Christmas story, fact of history or theological invention. You've given your reason there, Ben, saying that essentially, yes, we do have accounts that differ in some ways. Two perspectives is the way you've looked at it. One telling it from the male perspective, one from the female perspective. But let's not forget the similarities. And what was significant in what you said there is that you don't believe that Matthew and Luke were using each other. And for those who aren't perhaps familiar with what we mean by that, you mean that some of the Gospels, as it were, use material from other Gospels. So, so how does that usually work? Does Matthew borrow from Luke or Luke from Matthew? What's the normal order?
Well, they have different sources, aren't they? They all use different sources. They've got the Hebrew scriptures and they use that. Luke's got his own source. Then there's one that we call Q, and then there's different, and then his birth narrative. So, and Matthew uses Mark and Q, but Luke probably knows nothing about Matthew. So they have their different sources to create these theological teaching aids.
Right. But in your view, Ben, Matthew and Luke obviously weren't using each other.
No, I don't think I disagree with Stephen about what is usually called the synoptic problem. I think Mark is the earliest gospel. I think Matthew and Luke certainly used Mark and some kind of saying source. And they have other special sources, what are sometimes called special M and special L. And the birth narratives fall into the category of special sources that Luke and Matthew used independently of one another. So what's remarkable about what we have in Matthew and in Luke is, despite them having their own points of view and own agendas, they have some remarkable similarities in the story. And, of course, the most important of those is the virginal conception itself.
Indeed. Obviously, there's very little ink spilt in Mark on where Jesus came from. He sort of appears as a grown man in the story.
Right.
Why wouldn't Mark have included that, what is pretty significant aspect of Jesus? Or Paul, indeed.
Well, Paul does mention that Jesus was born of woman and born under the law. In other words, he had a Jewish birth. He certainly mentions that in Galatians, one of his undisputed letters. But you know, I am very hesitant to make much of arguments from silence. For example, in the case of the birth narratives, I don't think you can say, well, poor Mark, he didn't know any birth narratives, and poor Paul, he'd never heard the story of the origins of Jesus. We don't know that because they're writing with a limited amount of space, a limited amount of time, and they have specific purposes, and they may have mentioned these things on other occasions. I mean, in the case of Paul, we only have letters from him long after he's been a missionary. I mean, the very first letters we have from Paul are from his second missionary journey, not even from the first one. So we frankly don't know that they don't know those stories. What we can say is they don't directly mention them. That's true. So I don't want to load a lot into an argument from silence that says, well, they didn't know these stories, and therefore these stories were invented later. I don't think there's any strong historical reasons for thinking that.
Except the Gospels were written long after.
Oh, the Gospels were written in the last third of the first century A.D., not long after. I mean, Paul's still writing in the late 50s and perhaps into the early 60s, so I would put Mark towards the end of the 60s, which most scholars do. That's not long after.
Matthew was 85 or something?
Yeah, maybe in the 70s or 80s.
Is your point here, Stephen?
John West.
Is your point, Stephen, that the later, the more likely there's been some embellishment, some, as it were, theological additions have been inserted?
Yes, I don't see them as embellishments or theological additions. These people knew exactly what they were doing. They were teaching theological truth, and they taught it brilliantly. They're brilliant writings. The difficulty is, if people take them literally, they start worshipping these stories. What they need to do is dig deep, find the truth of these things. For instance, Matthew's gospel of these, including these visitors from the East, one of Matthew, who was a Jew, writing for Jews, wants everyone to know that this Jesus isn't just for Jews, he's for all the world. And the visit of these people from the East, whether they were kings, astrologers, wise men or whatever, right at the end of Matthew's gospel is the balance where Matthew says, go into all the world and tell the good news. So the point of the visitors from the East is, not that there were any, but the point of the story is that this Jesus comes for everybody, Jew and Gentiles, which was horrendous for Jews to hear. Fancy Gentiles being involved in this thing. They'd be horrified. And so that's the glorious truth there, and we rejoice in it.
I mean, I'm sure you would agree with the theological import of the Magi, Ben. It's just that you also are happy to believe that there was an actual event that goes with it.
Yeah, I think so. I don't think there's any reason to make up a story like that. What we know about ancient astrologers is that they were counselors to kings. We actually have a historical record of some Persian astrologers that went all the way to Rome to talk to the emperor about events that were going to come to pass. So we know that there were certainly itinerant astrologers, and that they frequently consorted with kings, and they were actually the counselors to kings. The story itself is not implausible from a historical point of view. But if you take a certain kind of interpretation of the star, then you can certainly make the story historically implausible, and I've already given reasons why I don't think we need to do that. But I certainly agree with what Stephen says about the meaning of the story. The meaning of the story is that Jesus is for everybody, I think. That's exactly right, and that's actually the same meaning of the shepherd's story. The story of Jesus is from the lowest for the lowest of the low all the way to the kings of the world. It's for everybody. I agree with that.
Splendid. That's great. So we agree that it's the truth that matters, whether the story is
actually... But the truth has a historical foundation.
Yes, Jesus. Jesus is the historical foundation.
I'd be interested to know, again, a question directed to you in this case, Ben. Why Matthew, if there were magi, and if there were shepherds as well who received the news, why Matthew, you know, has the knowledge on the one and Luke has the knowledge on the other, and wouldn't they both have been aware of this? Wouldn't that knowledge have filtered down and we should have the stories in both?
In the information age, we might assume that everything is available to everybody. I don't think that's true in antiquity. In antiquity, people had limited access to certain kinds of information, and it depends on the sources that Matthew or Luke used. Well, they couldn't be better than their sources. They couldn't say more than what their sources suggested, and I don't think they did. So they relied on the sources that they had, and we shouldn't assume that they are being selective. I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think Luke tells us what he knows on the basis of the sources that he has. He says, I've consulted eyewitnesses, and I have consulted the original preachers of this word, and I have written this down for a chap named Theophilus. Now, I take that preface to Luke very seriously. He says, I'm writing as a historian. I've done my research. I've gone to the trouble to go and consult the eyewitnesses and the original tellers of these stories, the proclaimers of this message. And I take that very seriously, because right after that preface, we have the story of Elizabeth and Mary. And these are not stories simply made up about the theological significance of historical events that didn't happen.
So,
they're stories about historically landmark events in human history.
So we have to ask, what was Luke's purpose? And Luke's purpose, Nero had just, Rome had just gone on fire, half of it burnt to a cinder, and everybody blamed Nero, the emperor, who was half mad anyway. And then Nero didn't want the blame, so he blamed the Christians. So the Christians were dreadfully persecuted. Then Nero dies, and time goes on, and Christians begin to emerge from their dreadful persecution. And Luke writes to tell Theophilus, a Roman, that they've nothing to fear from these Christians. They didn't burn Rome, and they've nothing to fear from them. So that's Luke's purpose in writing this gospel. He isn't writing history, he's writing an apology to the Romans to say, don't worry about these Christians. They're not going to burn Rome down, and they're not going to be revolutionaries. Actually, the Christians in the end did put an end to the Roman Empire, but Luke,
well, that's a later story.
Luke didn't know about that.
what do you make of that?
And what I would say to that is he's writing apologetic history. It is absolutely history. It's apologetic history writing. It's tendentious history writing. That's absolutely true. It's history writing with a point of view. There's no question about that. But it's not non-historical. I mean, the point of the story is to tell Theophilus the things that have happened amongst us. That includes historical events. So it's not just to say it's okay to be a Christian. Here's some nice stories that remind you of our theological truths. Even though they didn't really happen, they'll make you feel warm and fuzzy about being a Christian. No. He says, I'm going to tell the stories about the things that have happened amongst us, including the virginal conception.
I mean, the virginal conception, let's talk about that. Is it important not only that you're happy that there's enough reason to believe it as a historical fact, Ben? Is it important to you theologically that we hold on to that as a real event?
Here's the thing. First of all, there are no stories in Greco-Roman literature quite like this story. There are certainly some stories in Greco-Roman literature about gods like Zeus disguising themselves as men and coming down and raping women. That's not like this story. So there really aren't, outside the gospel, stories that are parallel to this particular story of the virginal conception. And the second thing is, in early Judaism, you would not make up a story like this. I mean, when you look at, for example, Origen arguing with the early Jew Celsus, one of the first things he points to is, well, Mary didn't have sexual relationships with a man that was her husband. Well, she must have had sexual relationships with some Roman soldier named Panthera, because otherwise we can't explain this conception of Mary. And, you know, if I am an apologetic writer like Luke is, I am not going to make up a story about a woman who gets pregnant out of wedlock with no aid of a man and say, this is the origins of my religion, because this story is too implausible not to be true. You don't make up a story like this.
Is this what sometimes called
a
criterion of embarrassment, that this
exactly
would not have made sense if you were trying to persuade someone of your case?
First century people would have laughed at this and said, oh, come on, we know the real story. She got knocked up out of wedlock. Of course that's what happened. And therefore it would be a shameful story, not a glorious story at all.
And I've heard others suggest that there are even traces, even though we aren't informed of a virgin conception in Mark or John, that you might get glimpses of questions over Jesus's parentage and that sort of thing.
Well, you certainly have that in John. In John, we have several arguments between the Jewish authorities and Jesus, and at one point they say, well, at least we're not illegitimate. You know, and so it seems pretty clear to me that the author of the Gospel of John knows the scandal of the story about Jesus.
All right. Well, we've got an argument here for the historicity of the virgin conception, then.
Yes.
Obviously, it's a miracle if it happened, Stephen.
Right.
Is that what makes you want to say, well, we just take this as metaphor, not as
No, as we're surrounded by miracles, I tell you. My congregations on a Sunday are all miracles, and I'm a miracle, and you're a miracle, and Ben's a miracle,
all right.
All miracles.
Well, was Mary's conception a miracle?
No. Luke, one of his points is the Roman Empire would accept a world religion but didn't like little sects. So they accepted Judaism. So Luke wants to say that this new religion isn't a little sect. It's a development of the Jewish faith that is acceptable to Rome. And so, of course, he looks back and he wants to show that it's a development of the Jewish faith. So he looks back to Isaiah 7, where the Hebrew says, and it's nothing to do with Jesus, it's about which king the Israel and the Judea people need to align themselves with, Babylon or Egypt. And there's this quote which says, look, a young woman's going to grow up, and it's a young woman, not a virgin. A young woman will grow up, and before and she'll give a birth to a son, and before this son is of age, both these kingdoms will have had a battle, and you'll be off into slavery. That's what it's about. And yet Luke can use it.
Well, it's Matthew specifically, isn't it, who uses the verse.
Yes, and Luke.
The virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and they shall name him Emmanuel.
Which yes, means God with so it. Matthew also is trying to show it's part of this story. But in Luke's Gospel, of course, it's they go to Bethlehem because he, Joseph, is of the house and lineage of David. Now, if it's nothing to do with Joseph, what's all that about? I thought it was nothing to do with Joseph, but it's Joseph who is of the house and lineage of David, and they want to show that Jesus is related to David. So Luke says, he, not her, he is of the house and lineage of David. So, of course, they want to show that this Jesus is very special and different from anything that the world has ever seen before, and this is one way of saying it, but to actually believe that this...
Let me just get this straight, then. How does the virgin conception tie into this? In what way would a virgin conception validate Jesus's kin, being in the line of David in particular? Because it, wouldn't... If
it wouldn't do that, but it would show that he's very connected with God. It's to show that this is a great connection with God, because...
Okay, so it's used as a...
How about if I leap in at this point?
Go ahead.
Yes.
several things. The first thing to be said is, you're right. Isaiah 7:14 says, an alma, a young woman of marriageable age, will conceive and give birth to a child. Now, it's an honor and shame culture. If you're going to talk about a shameful woman who's had sex out of wedlock, you don't use the word alma. So... no, it's not a technical term for virgin, but yes, it would be implied that she would be a virgin. This is why in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the LXX, it's Parthenos, which absolutely is virgin. It's a technical term for virgin, and Matthew is picking up that quote from the LXX, from Isaiah 7:14 in the Greek Old Testament. So that's point number one. But the second point that you make, I think, is absolutely right, Stephen. That prophecy in Isaiah 7:14, first of all, has a near-horizon a view of things in the first instance. But the point is that the prophecy is open-ended enough that it doesn't rule out a virginal conception. It doesn't specifically refer to it, but it doesn't rule it out. And so later readers of the text, like Matthew, could say, aha, well, it was prophesied. But here's the thing. The reason he's reading the story in Isaiah 7:14, which doesn't specifically refer to a virginal conception, is because he knows there was a virginal conception, and he's gone back to the Old Testament looking for a prophecy that would suit such a story. He's heard the story about the origins of Jesus involving a virginal conception. So has Luke. So it's the event in the life of Mary, an actual virginal conception, which leads to the reinterpretation of the prophecy in Isaiah 7:14.
Right, okay.
That's the order of events.
So the great difficulty with all that you've shared with us, the great difficulty is that the job of a Hebrew prophet, such as Isaiah, was never, ever, ever to foretell the future. They're telling the truth about the present.
But that's not true. It's both the present and the future.
No, it's not.
The prophets talk about Isaiah 40-66 is all about the future, even the distant future from when the prophet was
right,
writing.
Well, then we
so it is both forth-telling and foretelling.
Then we shall have to disagree with that. The job of a Hebrew prophet from our perspective, is to tell the truth about their present. It's not foretelling something that's going to happen 500 years later. For goodness sake, who on earth knows what's going to happen in 500 years? Do you know what's going to happen in 500 years? No, you don't, and neither did they.
Well, that's your opinion, I suppose. I mean, it all hinges on whether you believe in the miraculous, which prophecy is another...
Oh, I believe in the miraculous. So, I've told you, you're a miracle. Ben's a miracle. I'm a miracle. We're all miracles. And these are miracles of God.
Obviously, Ben, you're happy with the idea of Matthew then taking a prophecy in Isaiah and using it and saying, well, this must be what was being spoken of then.
Well, right. And so I would distinguish between prediction and fulfillment. What we're talking about in the case of Matthew is that he thinks that, in a very real sense, Jesus is the fulfillment of all the positive promises and prophecies of God that have come before. And this is one instance of that. But why this specific prophecy and why this specific event? Well, because it actually happened, and Matthew is looking for an Old Testament reference that says, you know, this was foreseen long ago, and that's why he lands on Isaiah 7:14. But let's talk for just a minute about the significance of why the virginal conception is important. Why is that important at all? Well,
not important
all,
to Paul, is it?
Well, I think it is,
all right.
Because he certainly believes Jesus is sinless. The reason it's important is because without a virginal conception, then Jesus simply inherits our sin nature. And that's precisely what the gospel writers and later writers, like the author of Hebrews, want to deny. The author of Hebrews says Jesus was tempted like us in every respect, but he was without sin. The point is that Jesus has come into the world in a condition so that he can be Adam gone right instead of a fallen human creature like us. He's not a fallen human creature like us. He's like the very first creature that God created before the fall, before sin. So he's being portrayed as like the starting over again of the whole human race. It's what Paul calls the last Adam. When Paul wants to talk about this kind of thing, he calls out Christ the eschatological Adam, the Adam who went right as opposed to went wrong.
I do understand that. I do understand that, and you have every right to understand that story and that understanding. That's fine. But there are a whole load of other Christians, such as myself, for whom that is, it doesn't really add up, even if this sinless business. As far as many of us are concerned, Jesus was human, fully human, isn't different from you and me, except in him we see all the glory of God. That's the only difference. He is a human kind.
A fairly significant difference, and I guess rather depends on what that glory would mean. Would that mean that Jesus was sinless?
No. He was humankind like you and me, and if he isn't a human being like you and me, then he isn't much use to us, really.
I mean, this...
Well, here's where I would say that sinning is not characteristic of humankind at the way God intended us to be. Sin is an aberration from the way God created us to be. To be human is to have limitations of time, space, knowledge, power, and to be mortal. Jesus was all of those things. That's what it means to be fully human. To sin is not to be truly human. It's to, in fact, violate the way God made us in the first place. And,
well, that's understanding that Adam was the first human, but I mean, that again is a story with a deep meaning.
We probably we don't have time to go into Adam and Eve per se on today's show. Obviously, this essentially is simply spelling out the difference in your theological approaches to Scripture and to doctrine as well, in many ways, gentlemen. And probably we're not going to come to either of you convincing the other in the space of today's programme. The virgin conception, though, just as we finish talking about that, you've said, Stephen, it's a device, if you like, a way of teaching that Jesus is, in some sense, from God, though you don't believe that we have to believe in it in a literal sense in order to take the meaning from the story.
Correct.
For you, though, Ben, yes, of course the virgin conception shows that Jesus is from God, but it's also important that we understand that as something that really happened because Jesus is from God, because this right. was something supernatural, God intervening in, quite frankly, a miraculous way in history in order to right. do something extremely special.
Well, exactly. And here's where I would also say that the historic Christian faith affirms that Jesus is both fully human and fully divine. He's not just a really special human being in whom we see the glory of God. Yes, that's true, but inadequate. It's not what the Christian faith has assumed or affirmed about Jesus over many centuries. That's not the faith for which Christians died through many centuries. They believed that he was both, as John Donne put it, 'twas much that we were made like God long before, but that God should be made like us much more. Jesus is the divine Son of God who took on flesh and dwelt amongst us. And that's not just a nice theological
Of course,
story.
I mean something entirely different by that. I can say that, but I mean something entirely different from you by that statement about the divine Son of God. I mean something entirely different from what you mean, which is fine, as long as you know that there are people who think very differently and still deeply Christian.
Well, we do have these discussions on a regular basis on this show. We're going to take another quick break, and we'll just have a few minutes to start to wrap things up. We've been talking about the Christmas story. It's brought us into the whole area of the nature of Christ and his whether was he sinless and so forth. But we started out with the Magi, the shepherds, the star, the census, and all that sort of thing. And we've had two very different opinions on the show today. Ben Witherington III from Asbury Theological Seminary in Kentucky, defending the Christmas stories as having a historical foundation, as well as, of course, having theological significance. Stephen Thornton, a liberal Christian, says that the Christmas stories aren't meant to be taken literally. They're there to teach us deeper truths. We'll be back in a moment's time as we continue the discussion on whether the Christmas story was a fact of history or a theological invention. Well, welcome back to Unbelievable. It's Saturday afternoon, and this is the nearly final show of the year, penultimate show of the year, our Christmas edition, hence the Christmassy music you've been hearing during today's programme. We'll be back with the final part of the discussion in a moment's time, but if you can join me for the final show of the year, just prior to New Year's Eve next Saturday, then you're going to be hearing a few different bits and pieces that I've been saving up over the past year. Not so much a discussion on the show, more some contributions from some well-known figures. William Lane Craig, who's well-known as a Christian philosopher and thinker, will be hearing his address to the UK church at last year's Be Thinking conference. That hasn't been released as yet, so that'll be an exclusive for anyone who's a fan of William Lane Craig and his writing, plus a few other things as well. So all that to look forward to on the show that aims to get you thinking unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, finishing up today's show, we've been asking whether the Christmas story is a fact of history or, if you like, a teaching aid for the early church, but not meant to be taken as literal history. Well, the latter view is that of Stephen Thornton, who's been on our show today, saying that we're not meant to take these stories of Mary, Joseph, the virgin birth, shepherds and angels literally. They're there to teach us deeper things. Ben Witherington III of Asbury Theological Seminary, perfectly happy to agree with Stephen that there is, of course, deep theological meaning to the Christmas stories, but you only get meaning from events that actually happened as well. And so he's not quite so keen to chuck the actual historicity of these events out of the window, while acknowledging that, of course, perhaps ancient biography doesn't, you know, follow the same standards of biography we might be used to today. Okay, Stephen, Ben finished up that section again, explaining why, from his perspective, you tend to lose a lot once you start to strip Christianity of these miracle events. He said earlier on in the show, there are just some things which seem irreducibly miraculous, that Christianity was born in miracle, in special events, God doing special things. The thing that's, I suppose, been ringing in my ears throughout this whole show is that while I'm not going to deny that you have a strongly held Christian faith as you have it, nonetheless, it's very different to, historically, the faith that many people have held, which involves really believing that God did things in history that significant.
God's always doing things in history.
Well why are you?
God is doing something now.
Why can't God do miraculous things like send angels and virgin conceptions and things like that? Why must those things have been simply a invention to use?
Well, I don't want to sound rude, but what I would say is that God is always doing miracles and doing wonderful things all the time, every day. But this is where I might sound rude, and I don't intend to be. God doesn't do silly things, and God doesn't do these
things. Are they silly things?
Yes.
Why are they silly?
And the other thing I want to say is that, I mean, I've spent my time training Anglican, Methodist and United Reformed Church ministers, and the people who say, thank God for that, when they hear the permission to ask all these questions and realise that they, for God's sake, don't have to believe in the virgin birth, and they don't have to believe this, and they don't have, and they're so relieved and thrilled, and they go out with a beam on their face, deeply Christian, but released from having to believe what they knew in their mind was nonsense, but couldn't really, didn't know they had permission to say, well, I don't actually think that.
What do you make of that, Ben?
Well, I'd first of all say that if everything is a miracle, then nothing is a miracle. And I would object to Stephen's definition of miracle. I certainly think there's a difference between the providence of God and the general blessing of God and actual miracles, and I think both things happen. So that would be point number one. And the second thing I would say is that it's not a relief to discover that the gospel story, including the birth stories, aren't true. That's not a relief. That's a horror story. That's suggesting that God doesn't really miraculously intervene and change lives and raise people from the dead and heal people. And that's what people living in a fallen world full of mortality and evil need. And so, you know, I don't see that it could be possibly a good thing to relieve people of the burden of having to believe that some of these stories actually happened. I don't think that makes a lot of sense to me.
Well, my first pastor was in Indiana, just across the Ohio River, and the people there, when I was sharing these, I was, thank God for that, they'd say, thank God, why didn't our ministers tell us that before? So they are greatly relieved, I assure you.
Well, they're relieved because then they don't have to believe things that, in fact, historic Christianity has told them that they have to believe. And I can understand relief from that point of view, but not relief in terms of an actual progress in their theological.
Yes, they're deeply Christian folks.
We're going to have to leave it there. It's been fascinating to hear two very different perspectives on this, and thank you both, gentlemen, for being with me today. If you want to find links to either of my guests, I'll post up where you can find them online. I'm not sure you've got much of an online presence, actually, Stephen, but
have an email.
Well, I can, if you're willing to share it, I'll put it out there, and then anyone who wants to agree or disagree with you can do it directly.
And just share our sorrow with the people in America.
Yes, and very rightly, Stephen wanted to say, here in the UK, we've obviously been hearing a great deal about the tragedy of the shooting in Connecticut, and we wanted to pass on our thoughts and prayers to you, Ben, and to everyone who is currently obviously living through that. So,
thank you very much. We appreciate that, and we want to wish everybody a happy Christmas, whether they're down under or in the UK or wherever they are.
And to you.
Thank you very much. Ben, I'm going to put your website as well if people want to follow you up with the podcast of this program. If you're listening, though, and you want to go straight there, benwitherington.com. If you want to find out what Ben does and what he blogs on a regular basis. But all the links for my guests and the ways to get in touch with me available from the webpage as usual. That's unbelievable. So premier.org.uk/unbelievable is the webpage if you're wanting to do that. In the meantime, my thanks again to my guests, Stephen Thornton and Ben Witherington. It's been great to have you with me, gentlemen, and a very happy Christmas to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
You know, whether God exists or not, kind of irrelevant to me.
Mock them, ridicule them. Are you seriously telling me you believe that?
It simply will not do to shut our eyes and say, I'm just going to preach the old-fashioned gospel. The title of our conference takes us to the heart of today's demands on Christians.
Unbelievable, the Conference 2012, giving a skeptical world reasons to believe. Now all the material from the conference, over 10 hours across three discs, is available on multi-region DVD. Join the hundreds of delegates who attended to hear strong, rational arguments for Christian faith and how to engage in evangelism, all delivered by world-class international speakers.
The Bible has 10 times as much to say about the origin and structure of the universe as all the rest of the world's holy books combined.
What I'm maintaining is that the most meaningful things in life, all of them point to God.
All of us have got a role to play in witnessing to Jesus.
Keep asking them questions and listen.
That begins to break the anger down, which begins to open the mind and the heart and the experience of God.
True faith is self-commitment on evidence, and apologetics presents that evidence.
I took the Dawkins line, you know, where he said, look at the evidence, try and find out.
The evidence for the resurrection, it really is a stumbling block for atheists. No matter how much they tell you it isn't, it is.
Reason and revelation are friends, not foes. We must be prepared to give to everyone an answer.
Give them reasons to believe.
The time would come when they would simply have to opt for a multiverse. It's the only place the atheist can go now.
I like to call it electrifying the fence on which they sat.
Unbelievable, the Conference 2012. Over 10 hours of material on how to put apologetics and evangelism together, all presented by internationally acclaimed speakers. Recorded in the heart of London, now watchable anywhere in the world on triple DVD. Order it now at premier.org.uk/DVD.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, if you'd like to get in touch, as usual, the normal methods apply. unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the email address. You can get in touch by a tweet, via Twitter, and tell me what you thought of today's programme. That's at unbelievablejb is the Twitter handle. And, of course, Facebook is available if you want to check out the Facebook page. There's also a group for Unbelievable. Lots of interesting discussions there between atheists and non-believers and Christians and so forth. So, premier.org.uk/unbelievable has all the links to those various places. And a lot of interest in last week's programme as well. That was New Testament scholar Mark Goodacre in discussion with Richard Carrier, one of the foremost mythicists about Jesus in the world. And so it goes a step further, obviously, than I guess Stephen today in terms of actually denying that Jesus even existed, which I think even Stephen would probably say is a step too far. But lots of you were encouraged to hear that debate going on. And here's what Ronnie had to say. He says, I was eagerly anticipating the Carrier-Goodacre discussion. It was very interesting, but definitely should have been a two-parter. Too much to unpack and discuss in such a limited time. I've always enjoyed Mark Goodacre, especially his tone, and I was excited when I heard he'd be on. Hopefully you can bring him back for something in the future. But what surprised me most was Carrier's tone. He came across extremely genial and willing to admit where he had the burden to support his claims. His responses to Ehrman seemed much less friendly. I'd love to hear more from him again. Great discussion overall. Just wanted more. Looking forward to Ben Witherington III. Hope you enjoyed today's programme as well then, Ronnie. Thanks for getting in touch. Here comes Corby saying, I liked Dr. Carrier. He was modest, winsome and respectful, and because of that, I wanted to check out 1 Corinthians and Galatians to see what Paul said about Jesus. I wanted to see if Carrier made any sense at all. And just to remind you, this isn't Corby now, me, just to remind you that Richard Carrier's argument last week essentially was that Paul, in as much as he had a revelation of Jesus, it was of a purely spiritual nature, that it was not of a flesh and blood historical Jesus, and that's what we get in the letters of Paul. Well, here's Corby going to some of the parts of scripture, Paul's letters that Richard Carrier mentioned. He says, here's some of what I found. Firstly, Jesus Christ was publicly portrayed as crucified, Galatians 3:1. Publicly portrayed here is the Greek prographo, the
BDAG Greek lexicon tells us that this word means to set forth for public notice, show forth, portray publicly, proclaim or placard in public. Crucified means to fasten to a cross. Secondly, Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us, for it is written, cursed is everyone who is hanged on a tree. Galatians 3:13. Tree here means tree, as in the real variety that grows in the ground. Thirdly, the Lord Jesus, on the night when he was betrayed, took bread after supper. 1 Corinthians 11:23. Kind of obvious what this means. And so carries on, number four, for as by a man came death, by a man has come also the resurrection of the dead. 1 Corinthians 15. Man here is the Greek word anthropos. And the BDAG tells us it means a person of either sex with focus on participation in the human race, a human being. And so you conclude here, Corby. On the face of it, this Jesus Christ Paul is speaking of was fastened to a cross, crucified in a public place before people. The night before this public crucifixion, he had supper, did something with bread and a cup. The same night he had supper, took bread and did something with a cup, he was betrayed. And this Jesus Christ, in contrast to the human being that brought death, Adam, was the human being that brought the resurrection of the dead. The simplest explanation for these propositions is a historical Jesus. You add more to that, but that is the essence of what you're saying there. And you finish off by saying, please get Larry Hurtado on and have a show debating how early Jesus was worshipped as God. Well, if you haven't come across it already, Corby, Richard Borkham did a very similar job a few years ago on the programme on how early the view that Jesus was divine emerged. He obviously makes the case that it was extremely early. So you might want to dig that one out. Jesus and the God of Israel is the name of the show that you're looking for in the archives. Anyone else? Yes, here we go. Nathaniel in Alabama on Carrier says, I carefully listened to this week's show and thought I must not be understanding Dr. Carrier's argument. That's because I kept thinking to myself, surely he wouldn't present such an unconvincing argument. But what do I mean by unconvincing? Why not also argue that if we notice a pattern of Christian people who are rude, thoughtless and prone towards bad fashion, any new person you meet who is a Christian will therefore also be rude, thoughtless and prone towards bad fashion? Or maybe if we have a consistent experience of atheists who make poor arguments against the existence of Jesus, that any new atheist, pun intended, you meet will therefore also make poor arguments against the existence of Jesus. This is lazy thinking. The lazy person allows him or herself to notice superficial similarities between people and then just gloss over significant differences. Someone in the ancient world, maybe I'm mistaken, but it seems rather plausible that if God was going to communicate to someone in the ancient world, one might expect there to be some relevant similarities in the themes of his revelation. It seems Dr. Carrier's argument will force him to see all ancient religious literature through a hermeneutic of embellishment, even if significant differences abound. He will just have to begin measuring any new evidence with the same conclusions he has drawn from the past. Thank you very much, and a few other people get in touch as well on that that programme with Richard Carrier and Mark Goodacre of last week. And one final one to mention, Dave Kirkland in Moscow, Idaho, USA, says thanks for the continued hard work at Unbelievable. Excellent job. I enjoy the shows very much. Regarding the show on Did Jesus Exist, I enjoyed it but didn't find Carrier's arguments compelling, logical or persuasive. He does simply seem hyper-sceptical, and I don't believe it's logical to assume Jesus Christ didn't even exist. By his logic, it seems like we would have to start being sceptical whether or not many, many supposed ancient figures actually existed. First of all, the reports of the life of Jesus from the four Gospels are in-depth reports with historical details that can be investigated, and were all written less than about 80 years after the life of Jesus. I've listened to J. Warner Wallace do a podcast on Please Convince Me, where he outlined other sources outside the Gospels mentioning the crucifixion. I fail to understand why a fair number of sources would all bother to write such detailed accounts of a fake life of a person named Jesus who never existed. Seriously, what would be their motivation in that time period? There was no money to be made from books or hits on websites. For example, a very few people today say the Holocaust never happened, and I don't see masses of people putting their lives on the line for that story. I've posed the other question before. If the life of Jesus was fake, why did no one bother to write down something to refute the Gospels and straighten things out right then? As this huge movement of Christianity gained popularity and momentum in Acts, I would assume someone, or maybe many writers, would pen something to clear this up. If it was all a myth, and there never was a man named Jesus Christ, Finally, I wanted to mention that Ravi Zacharias said on one of his podcasts that an inscription was actually found on an ancient church building in the Mediterranean that said, "Lazarus, friend of Jesus Christ." Historians think that this was the Lazarus that Jesus was said to have raised from the dead in the Gospels, and Lazarus went on to preach powerfully for years after that. Maybe we could find out more about that claim as well. I find it all very interesting and exciting. Merry Christmas and God bless. Thank you, Dave, for getting in touch. Let's go to one or two others. Going back to the debate between Peter Hitchens and atheist Alex Gabriel that we aired, the one that took place in Oxford University. Lots of response to that. And here's the latest one in from Shane. Says, "I'm a Christian based in Cape Town, sunny Cape Town in South Africa. Thank you for a great show. I've been greatly challenged over the past 2 or 3 years by atheists in my faith. At the outset, many of the questions created problems of doubt and uncertainty. However, after reading, researching through the vast amounts of information available, I'm more convinced of the complete soundness of the Christian faith. I'm thankful for the doubting, which has actually resulted in a much stronger, fuller, and intellectually fulfilling faith. Through the web searches, I discovered your podcast in October this year and have worked through 90% of the programmes." You must have been listening on 24-hour cycle or something, Shane, if you only started in October. "Anyway, you say, what I enjoy the most is the civil and cordial approach the guests show when interacting with one another. I feel it really embraces the true spirit of tolerance and understanding. I also find that the programme does well in helping me understand the reason for opposing beliefs and so strengthens my own personal convictions. Another reason for this email is the Hitchens and Gabriel debate 2 weeks back. I laughed, cringed and ended up feeling sorry for Alex. I really thought the Paul Witz theory of a connection between atheism and fatherlessness was really evident in Alex Gabriel's reasoning." Interesting. I haven't come across that. Might have to look into that. "Atheism and Fatherlessness" by Paul Witz, apparently. And there's a summary of his observations at the Wintry Night blog. So if you want to check that out, do go along there and type in "Why do famous atheists believe that God does not exist?" "I wonder for a future programme if you could get Paul Witz to discuss and explore that further. I've not heard a good reasoned academic response to the observation, apart from blogosphere trash talk." Well, I can imagine, sounds like just reading the title of it, a controversial theory that people become atheists because they didn't have fathers, I'm guessing is what it boils down to, which I can imagine there's a few listeners of Unbelievable who would have a thing or two to say about that. So if we do get Paul Witz on, I'm sure we won't be short of a person or two to go up against him. I've had other people recommending guests as well. I'm always open to your suggestions for guests and show topics. Indeed, I put a call out on the Facebook page of Unbelievable in the last week, asking if there were any topics or guests you'd like to see in 2013. Well, I was inundated with responses, and I'm going to read out some of the ideas that have been put forward on next week's show as we look towards the new year. But let me say right now, if you're someone who doesn't interact via the Facebook or Twitter account, and you'd like to suggest a guest, do get in touch. I obviously don't have time to implement all the suggestions that come in. There are far too many, and I do have to pick and choose between them. But where something really catches my eye, it very often has resulted in a show appearing at some point down the line. So it very much is a listener-driven focus to the show on many occasions. So if you have an idea and you've thought of a burning topic or a great guest of Christian or non-Christian persuasion, do get in touch and let me know your thoughts. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And here's another one. This is from someone who, again, came up a couple of weeks ago, wants to see Alonzo Fife on the show. He runs the Atheist Ethicist blog. This is after the show we did looking at the moral argument. And again, the complaint here is that you invite atheist bloggers and college students on, but very rarely a philosopher. And I've yet to hear an ethicist on the programme talking about the moral argument. Try Alonzo Fife. His views on morality are beginning to receive quite a bit of attention among atheists in the blogosphere and on the web in general, and I believe he could generate a fascinating and challenging discussion with someone like William Lane Craig or Paul Copen. Thank you very much indeed for the suggestion. Well, that's all we've time for now. We'll get more of your mail, of course, at the same time next week as we look forward to the new year, a special New Year's edition of Unbelievable. And let me tell you what's coming up on that programme. And we've got some exciting stuff to come in the new year as well.
You're unbelievable.
Well, as we look ahead to the new year on next week's programme, we're going to be hearing some exclusive material, particularly from the Be Thinking Apologetics Conference of last year. This is material that as yet hasn't been released, including William Lane Craig's address to the UK Church on the importance of apologetics, and lots of really interesting stuff he had to say in that. So tune in, same time next week or via the podcast, to hear that. Plus, we'll be hearing about your suggestions for 2013 and other bits and pieces that I've got lined sort of up my sleeves, as it were. So that's next week's show. Hope you can come back for that at the same time for the final show of 2012. In the meantime, thank you for being with me, and I hope you have a really happy Christmas and all the very best to you wherever you stand on the faith issues that we discuss on a regular basis here on the programme. And all the very best for the new year as well. In the meantime, have a great week. I've been Justin Brierley. I'll see you next time.
This summer, saddle up with the only sportsbook where you can bet on horse racing, FanDuel. Right now, new customers can get a no-sweat first bet up to $500. That's right, you'll get up to $500 back in racing credit if your first horse racing bet doesn't win. With FanDuel Sportsbook, you can even watch and bet select races live right in the app. So, bet horse racing on the same app where you bet all your other favorite sports. FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. Just download the app or go to FanDuel.com/horses to score your no-sweat bet up to $500. 21 plus and present in Ohio. Offer valid on first real money wager of $5 or more. Verified FD racing account required. Bonus issued in non-withdrawable racing site credit that expires 7 days after issuance. Max refund $500. Restrictions apply. See terms at racing.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.